Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 25th of January 2022. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on board. And we're going to have a really interesting conversation this evening with Victor and Steve. All things political plus economic plus whatever you want to talk about, really. So there'll be plenty of room for some questions. Just before I bring them in, let me just remind you, as I always do, we don't provide specific advice here, financial, legal or anything else. General conversation only. The chat is moderated. Please take that into account. This is as of 25th of January. If you're watching in replay, if you would like to get my attention, use @walktheworld and make sure that then I'll see your question, because I'm very encouraging other people to have conversation in the chat. But if you want to get my attention, use @walktheworld. Also, I've enabled Super Chat. And if you'd like to get your question on top of the list, use Super Chat. Or indeed, if you'd like to make a contribution to what we do, that can also be done via Super Chat. Right. Well, without further ado, I'm going to see whether we can bring Victor and Steve in. And I think, Steve, you're on first. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Not too badly, Mike. I'm in bed because I have a bum knee. Uh-huh. And I'm with a computer who was a bum computer over the weekend. So it's my some of my trials and tribulations. Otherwise, I'm fine.
Well, good to see you. And thanks for spending some time. And Victor, are you there?
Yes, I am. And both my computer and my knee are working. It's fine. Thank you.
Smart ass. Okay.
Well, it's good to have you both on again. And it's more than a month ago since we were chatting policy and politics and everything else. And things are really hotting up towards the election, if we don't know what the date is. But one of the questions that I had from a number of people beforehand was TNL, right? Because you've basically done a bit of rebranding and repositioning around TNL, Victor. Can we just clear that up and explain why that's where you're going?
So the rebranding was kind of forced upon us because the Liberal Party of Australia challenged our right to use the word Liberal in our name. They lost that, but they went on appeal and they won the appeal. Now, we could take it further to the High Court if we had time and money. But we've decided that discretion is the better part of valour in this. And we've been using TNL as an abbreviation for the New Liberals for a long, long time. So from here on in, we will be interchangeably the New Liberals and TNL right up to the ballot, because the challenge to our name is only our right to use that name on the ballot paper. So we will have to be on the ballot paper and our how to vote cards, of course, just TNL. We're sort of transitioning towards that anyway to avoid confusion. But we are and always will be the New Liberals. That's our name and our legal status. And we'll use that wherever appropriate.
Okay, right. So people should be interchanging TNL and the New Liberals and understand that there's a reason why the acronym has become slightly more centre stage.
That's right. Yep. Exactly right. Yep.
Okay. And good. Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up. People were a bit confused as to, you know, what was driving it. But the point is there that there are people out there who are trying to stop some of the minor parties from having a voice and being heard and all those things. You know, they changed some of the other rules, didn't they, in terms of numbers of members you need and all those sorts of things to try and make it more difficult.
Well, they did. They've actually succeeded in wiping out about 30 minor or emerging parties by just tripling the membership overnight and giving people almost no time to achieve that. So that you'll see dozens of parties being deregistered. Many have already been deregistered. We were lucky we didn't have that problem. We had enough members. And they also brought in legislation to give themselves, it was supported by the Labor Party, of course, and to give themselves monopolies over the word Liberal and Labor. And so, I mean, that's part of the reason we said, well, we've just got to give up, because if we won in the High Court, if the High Court said, as they probably would, that nothing about being called the New Liberals is misleading, then the Liberal Party would use the new legislation to say, well, we've got a monopoly on that word and we can knock you over on that one. So they had us from every angle. As I say, because people know us as much as TNL as the New Liberals, that's what we'll be transitioning into.
And of course, you want to fight the right battles, not the legal battles, right?
So, well, like, there are bigger battles. Absolutely. As a lawyer, I can tell you that is absolutely right. The legal battle is the thing you do only out of desperation. You've got no other choice.
Yeah. Exactly. And congratulations, you were recently on Sky, right? And you have got, I think, quite a good run from what you were saying.
Well, on Sky News, and that's it's a very interesting development from our point of view. We, that's a central Murdoch forum, and it was quite surprising. And it was surprising to be asked, and it was surprising, I think, to get an even-handed run. So things are afoot.
No, it's good. And talking of afoot, Steve, we should briefly mention the ABC article, which had a very interesting discussion about economics and specifically your recent outings, as it were. From my perspective, the ABC did a pretty good job in terms of actually presenting a really good, interesting set of arguments. Oh, he's gone.
Okay. One thing about the general approach of the neoliberals is we disown neoliberal policies in general and neoclassical economics in particular, and that's one reason I've come on board. The party itself, through Victor's work, researched it and realised that the arguments the government has to tax in order to spend and so on are fallacious. So that was known by the party before I was brought on board. But the fact the party was aware of that is why I decided to come on, first of all, as an advisor and then as a Senate candidate. And the fundamental point is the economy has been stuffed up by trying to turn it into a first-year economics textbook. And the trouble is both the leading parties think that's what you should do to the economy, turn it into a first-year economics textbook. And as I've spent my academic career showing that their textbook is nonsense. It doesn't describe the real world at all. I call it Tolmake economics. It's as accurate a description of the real economy as Tolmé's Earth-centric view of the universe was a description of the solar system, which, of course, anything but. Now, the trouble is once you've been seduced into that way of thinking, it's very hard to break out of it, and both Labor and Liberal are afflicted by that way of thinking. And what, as a result, they've both pushed comparative advantage and trade specialisation, which now has us being about 80th in the world in terms of complexity, ranking below Zimbabwe in terms of the complexity of the goods we can produce, dependent upon two or three commodities, which themselves, particularly the fossil fuel end, may cease being tradable in the next decade. We've got a very fragile economic system that's been brought home by COVID as well. And what I do in my book, The New Economics, is say there's an alternative way to think about the economy, which gives you a much more robust creature. But of course, we're doing it as a sort of repair job after 40 years of neoliberalism. And that was well covered by the ABC article by Michael Yander.
Yeah, no, it's a very good article. And interestingly, he also featured the other really critical point about credit creation, right? And the reference back to the Bank of England article, which, of course, was a very, very important article when it came out. You know, a lot of people, I think, missed it when it first came out, but it was really the culmination of a whole series of thinking about the way that credit actually works in reverse to the way that you think about it. And actually, that's a really important thing to bolt into the way that the economic conversation needs to run, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why we had a financial crisis was too much private credit being created. And the reason it wasn't seen by the Reserve Bank or any of the central banks around the world is they swallowed the textbook argument that banks lend out deposits. And for 50 years, there's been protest groups in economics, actually starting, of all things, with the research director of the New York Fed, trying to stop the Fed going into Milton Friedman's monetarism way back in the late 60s, early 70s. But we've been saying for decades that that's not how banks work. Banks create money when they create deposits. They give you a loan, which is their asset, and they give you a liability, which is the bank deposit. They're both created at the same time. It's got nothing to do with reserves, nothing to do with needing deposits. It actually creates deposits. Now, we've been arguing that for 50 years and being ignored by the mainstream. And then out comes the Bank of England and the Bundesbank, and ultimately even the Bank of Norway came out the same way and said, that's wrong. Banks create money when they lend. They don't need deposits to lend. Now, what that means is, of course, banks are effectively far less constrained in their lending processes than the textbook argument says. And also, and this is the important point that is probably the thing I've made the major academic contribution to. Credit is part of aggregate demand and aggregate income. So if you don't control credit, you can have runaway private money creation, creating additional aggregate demand during a boom through pumping up a housing bubble, and then it crashes on the other side. And you simply have to control that. You can't let that happen. Otherwise, you have financial crises like 2008 all the time. So we've got an awareness of that, as well as an awareness of what's called modern monetary theory. And they both change how we see the creation of money. And I know a lot of people think, oh, you know, what are you guys saying? You're better than textbooks. The Bank of England says we're better than the textbooks. Okay. And the thing is, the mainstream is not listening. So Paul Krugman, just a matter of weeks ago, published an article saying how it must be the banks don't see any lending opportunities because look at the high level of reserves, arguing for lending out reserves. That's garbage. The mainstream refuses to learn. They've got almost a religious attitude towards this stuff. We're saying we're being realistic. We understand what the Bank of England said. That completely changes how we think about banks creating money and also how the government creates money. And we intend both harnessing one capacity, the government's capacity to create money, controlling the other to stop us having yet more financial bubbles.
And the other point there, of course, is if in fact it is private credit that can be expanded, you know, pretty much ad infinitum, so for as long as you can find people who are willing enough to borrow more, the banks can get bigger and bigger and bigger and become effectively ever bigger share of the overall economy, which distorts the overall economy and effectively creates the sort of edifice that we've got, where we've got very high house prices, huge amounts of debt, and not a lot else.
Exactly. And that's, again, within my own modelling of mathematical modelling of financial instability, that turns up as a byproduct. Rising levels of private debt mean increasing inequality because it gives more of the income to bankers, but rather than coming at the expense of capitalists, that income comes at the expense of workers. So fundamentally, the poor and the working class are paying for the high level of private debt, even though they're not necessarily the ones doing the borrowing in the way that I model it. So what we have is massive inequality, an unstable system, one which is likely to crash because of the excessive levels of private debt, and not sufficient amount of government money creation because of this crazy idea of seeing the government as being like a household, which has to borrow money from another household if it's going to spend more than it earns, whereas the government is a money creator. And we then have to say the government can therefore finance anything. The question is it worth financing, and do we have the resources necessary to fulfill that financing? Those are the questions, not whether the money is available, and certainly not whether you have to borrow it, because the governments do not need to borrow to be able to spend.
Absolutely, and that's some very important messages. So, folks, if you've not read that ABC article, I will put the link in below. It is worth reading because I think it's actually a very good and well-argued and well-positioned piece. But it really does highlight some of those fundamental drivers which are driving the decisions of the major parties and why they're doing what they're doing and why what they're doing doesn't necessarily work and get you where you want to get to, right? Because if you look at the outcomes, we haven't got the outcomes that we need as a country, really.
Well, no, we've been deindustrialised. Pardon me, Victor.
Oh, I was just going to jump in there, if I may. I'm out in the hustings every day now, and I'm just fascinated that the average person completely understands when I say to them in lay terms, a sovereign government isn't constrained in what they spend by the taxes they raise. And when a sovereign government spends on something, it's an investment in the economy, not a cost. And it stimulates the economy because every dollar we put into the hands of, you know, the hitherto unemployed or the business that's been destroyed by COVID gets spent and re-spent across the economy. Everybody gets that. That's the fascinating thing, that the neoclassical model, which the leading political parties pump out into the economy, isn't believed, you know. And that I found that both pleasant and surprising.
Yeah, that is interesting. And, I have chats with people sometimes around what's wrong with, you know, economics and politics. And it seems to me that actually if you talk to real people out in the street, they've got a much better sense of the way things are and what's really going on. Another example, right? The inflation numbers came out today, right? Mm. And inflation was a little higher. But people will say, well, that doesn't reflect my lived experience. You know, for me, the cost of living are way, way higher. So people are much, much more connected to reality than the official statistics and some of the official organisations. And I'm not sure what that means in terms of how you bridge the gap, right? Because you've got a political set of processes and a political set of ideologies that are driving the two major parties into a particular version of the future, when what I think you would be saying is that isn't actually a sensible, legitimate future. We need a different story, a different narrative.
That's right. And I think that the Labor and Liberal parties have proceeded successfully on the basis that they are the only alternatives, so that if they're both putting out neoclassical economics that nobody believes, people have got to vote on another point of view. You know, they've got to accept they're both talking rubbish. So which one of them are we going to pick? Now, the reason that that duopoly is crumbling, and the reason why many of us around the country are convinced that they're on the way out and that the next government will be a minority government with a huge crossbench comprised of Greens, Independents and ourselves, is because we are, and others are, putting out alternative arguments, and people have an alternative place to put their ballot.
Right, and that is alternatives that are realistic and sensible, right, and to can be communicated. And I guess a good example of that, Steve, is the housing policy that you've now put out. And I wouldn't mind moving on and talking about that in perhaps a bit more detail now that it's officially out there. And it got a lot of very positive support amongst social media, people saying this is actually a pretty revolutionary and pretty remarkable stake in the ground. So can we just go through sort of some of the key principles and what it is that effectively the housing policy from the New Liberals is trying to achieve?
Okay. Well, the starting ground is what's caused high house prices. And the answer is too much credit. Banks have been lending money to enable people to buy homes. And because we all talk about the supply being fairly rigid, it's changes in demand which actually cause changes in prices. And when you look at what causes changes in demand, it's changes in new levels of mortgages. So there's a very strong correlation, whether you're in a country which has had a housing bubble and burst, or one which hasn't, like Australia, between increasing levels of new mortgage debt and increasing house prices, and falling levels of new mortgage debt and falling levels of house prices. So it comes down to saying this: the secret to having realistic house prices is to control credit that's used to buy houses. Don't let too much money be created, because that'll give you a Ponzi, a bubble and a Ponzi scheme. So that's the starting point. Now, of course, we've allowed too much money to be created for housing speculation. In Australia's case, that's driven the level of household debt from about 20% of GDP in the 70s to 120% of GDP in the noughties. And that is far more of an increase in the level of debt than there's been a fall in the rate of interest. People think one's gone up, the other's gone down. No, the increase in debt's been far higher than the fall in interest rates. So we have people now being effectively indebted to a rentier version of capitalism, where you make money out of ownership, not out of innovation. And that's actually destructive for the creativity of the economy as well. So we say two things. First of all, we want to remove the encouragement to borrow money that currently exists in the system, because, say, Victor and I were fighting over the same flat in North Sydney and both had the same income, then the one of us who would win that contest would be the one who borrowed more money, took on more leverage. So we're going to show positive encouragement now when we're contesting a particular house to get more leverage than another person. So our way of controlling that is to say we will start off with the current level of the ratio between mortgage debt and rental prices, to say that ratio cannot be exceeded. It started about, now it's about 20 to 1, but a proper ratio should be about 10 to 1. So we'd start off at 20 to 1 and gradually over years reduce that ratio, so the amount of money you could borrow would be ultimately no more than 10 times the annual rental income of the property. Now, if you think about that in terms of current prices, that will cause an absolute plunge in prices, which we want to bring over in a gradual way. We believe prices have to fall. We don't want to have that fall in prices, meaning that people who've bought into the mortgage, buying a house by mortgage, seeing owning a home as a legitimate target, they have been fooled by the banking sector. So we don't want them to suffer out of it. So our proposal is to say we allow too much credit-based money to be created. What we need to do is replace that credit-based money with fiat-based money, what we call a monetary reset. And this has all been modeled by Minsky software. And the idea would be we give an identical amount of money to every adult in the economy. If that money is equal to or less than the amount of debt that person owes, then that money is written off against their debt. So they don't get an increase in the money supply, their own money, but their debt levels fall. And therefore, if we mention somebody who's got a mortgage, let's say you've got a mortgage of $1 million and you own a house which might be valued at $2 million, and our policies might reduce their house price, let's say by $200,000. Well, we're also going to be reducing your debt over time by $200,000. So your equity doesn't fall. The major principle is we don't want the equity of current homeowners to be reduced by the policy we're doing. What we want to do is, first of all, reduce house prices. So that's going to reduce the gross value of the homes, but reduce the debt as well. So the net value remains the same. They've got the same equity. And then that will mean, because we're giving it to the same monetary reset to everybody, people who are renting right now and can't afford to get in the market, they will get a monetary injection, which can take the form of government bonds, not actual cash. And those government bonds mean we're compensating them for 40 years of policies which have been biased in favour of people who've bought properties on mortgage rather than the people who have forced into renting. And when we look at what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a dramatic decline in home ownership. The number of people who own their homes outright with no mortgage has fallen from about 43% of the population to 30%. The percentage that owns a house with a mortgage have risen from something like 20 to 30%. Those that have renting have risen from 20 to 35%. So all the objectives of government policy were to increase home ownership, and they've done the exact opposite. So we say we have to reverse that and stop the government stuffing up the market. So in this sense, we're saying the government adventures made the system worse and make it remove the unfairness that's been generated. Reduce house prices to make them more affordable by young people, but do it in such a way that doesn't reduce the equity of those who are currently homeowners. Right. We're not saying it's easy, by the way,
no. Okay?
But these are the objectives overall. And it is worth looking at the entire policy to see how it all fits together.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll put the link below, but the policy is quite detailed in terms of the way it all flows through. But the fundamental principle is you can't just go on doing the same as we've done over the last 40 years and expect a different outcome. You need a different set of levers to be able to change that, right? Because otherwise you just end up with ever higher house prices, more debt, and a narrower economy.
Yeah, and if you, one of the punchlines is there's no such thing as affordable, expensive housing. And all the policies which are supposedly being directed to make housing more affordable by giving people money to buy the houses, have actually made houses less affordable. And then that's benefited people who see themselves as having their wealth tied up in housing. So that's all been driven by debt at the same time. So people have been focusing on the price of their house without considering effectively the debt that let them buy that house. And it's both going up, which has caused the overvaluation. We want to bring them both down. But do it in a way that doesn't end up penalising homeowners who bought a home with a mortgage debt. And if we just had house prices fall without the mortgages fall, they'd be wiped out. And of course, that's what happened in America. You had a 40% fall in house prices over there with no change in the level of mortgage debt. So people were sent bankrupt. They had to do jingle mail and stuff like that. We want to prevent that happening, while still having the outcome of bringing house prices down so they're more affordable, and then make housing something which is fundamentally a consumer item. It's not an investment. It should be something that people live in for the long term. And we want to give people home security. And that's also part of our policies on homelessness as well, which are ancillary to the affordability. But the overall objective is to stop treating housing as a financial asset that's only benefited real estate agents and the banking sector and the newspapers that the Domain and so on that make their money out of advertising houses for sale. It hasn't benefited the rest. It's actually hollowed out the economy, and it's time we started deepening the economy rather than having an economy based, as one of my friends says, on houses and holes.
And what does that mean then for the banks? Because, of course, they have been inflating themselves and their balance sheets and their profits because they've been lending more and more and more. And, of course, they've been supported by the Term Funding Facility and the Reserve Bank and all the other. So is the role of a bank then changing in your model?
Yeah, I mean, this is the other element to it, because if you go back to the 50s and 60s, and most of us here are in the conversation old enough to remember those times, they used to talk about banks being a 363 business. Borrow at 3%, lend at 6%, and be on the golf course by 3 p.m. And when you look at what was happening with the banks back in those days, most of their money was made out of bonds. So the government would run a deficit. The government would then cover that deficit with bonds. The money to buy the bonds was created by the deficit itself and the reserves. So the banks would then buy those bonds and then get paid a 3% rate of interest on those bonds. And that's where most of their money came from. Now, when you had the obsession on the neoliberal way of thinking, where they don't understand banking, if you read a non-economics textbook, your level of intelligence on banking goes down, not up. Okay. But if you look at that model, they ignored the whole role of banks in creating money, ignored the fact that banks were effectively getting a 3% rate of interest to finance having the deposit accounts that the public has. It's like a public service in that sense. That's what it used to be. And so with that decline in the amount of money they could make out of bonds coming out of the decline in deficits being run and so on, the banks saw another opportunity, which was to sell bricks and mortar, debt on bricks and mortar to the rest of us. And so they had this huge explosion in mortgage debt. And that has ended up giving the banks great power over the rest of society, but in a totally non-creative way. So rather than lending for entrepreneurs and working capital and large consumer items, they've lent for a Ponzi scheme. And that's why they're so powerful now, because if you're Mr. Ponzi and you haven't been exposed yet, you own the government. And that's what we've really got these days, a sort of financial political complex, which we want to get away from. But if we sell bonds to back the monetary reset, and the bonds are then bought by the banks with the money created by the reset itself, that then gives them that 3% rate of interest, which means they get a reasonable return, but they go back to being servants of capitalism and not masters of capitalism. And that's what they should be.
And that's a very fundamental shift, right? Very important shift. And it basically puts the banks back in their box and makes them enablers of commerce and the enablers of society, rather than actually generating, well, superior profits from just ever more loans.
Yeah, and we turned into a rentier system, with finance being the foundation of the rentier behaviour. And if you want to find enemies of rentiers, yes, you can challenge Karl Marx. You can also find Adam Smith and David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill. So it's a common attitude in the great economists was, we don't want to have a capitalism dominated by rentiers. We want a capitalism dominated by entrepreneurs. And in that situation, you want finance to be the servant of the industrial manufacturing sectors, not the master. But when you let a Ponzi scheme take off, like we did in the 1920s with the roaring 20s, and we did in the 2000s and the noughties, you get a rentier system, and it's uncreative. It doesn't grow anywhere near as fast as it used to, and you end up with a debilitated economy. So we've seen that fate. We've already acquired it. We want to back our way out of it. And it won't be easy, but it is feasible.
Mm. Yeah, well, absolutely. One of the reasons why this is a really important debate is because we have to think differently, because if we just continue to think the same, we're going to end up with the same problem again, right? So this is why this is an important conversation. Great. Well, let me just move the conversation on then. Victor, I want to come back to you and talk a little bit about education policy. So there were a few questions in the chat about universities, but also more broadly about education. How important is education, investing in education? How do we pay for it? And what are the limitations that we're currently seeing at the moment, and how does that need to change?
Well, every thinking person knows that all great societies are built on their education systems. You can't have a great society if the majority of people are not educated. So education is the bedrock of society. Now, what's happening to our public education system at the moment, it's being left to rot and we want to turn that round. So it's not a question of how do you pay for it. It's the same old thing. A sovereign government can invest in whatever it wants to invest in. And if it chooses to invest in creating the best public education system in the world, as we intend to do, then you not only get the best public education system in the world with all the great benefits that flow on from that, but every dollar that's spent on building a building or hiring a labourer or training a teacher gets spent and re-spent across the economy and stimulates all sectors of that economy. Now, when you have this neoclassical economic idea that how can you afford it, then you get into an us and them situation where you say, well, if we're going to afford a better public education system, of course, we have to take the money off the private education system. And of course, you don't have to do that. So what our plan is to not decrease the per capita funding of private schools, because we'll see no need to do that, but rather increase the quality of public education whilst leaving the per capita of private schools the same, per capita funding of private schools the same. But we believe that over time, and it's a long-term thing, perhaps in excess of 50% of those that send their children to private schools will realise they can get a better education. And as we see in some of the Scandinavian countries, a better education without any of the cost in the public system. Now, I give an anecdotal example of how this can work because I think they're useful. And it goes back in time a bit where my brother-in-law was living up on the North Shore of Sydney, and I think it was Killara High. I hope I haven't got it wrong. Killara High, for whatever reason, was very well appointed. So it had the things that private schools had. It had, you know, a gymnasium and a tennis court and a swimming pool and a little theatre and you know, the best teachers from around the place. And he looked at that, and he was a man then who could easily have afforded to send his three children to one of the private schools around the place. But he said, why should I do that? Why should I spend the money on that when I know they will get a great education from Killara High? And he sent them there, and they did. And they went on to very successful lives and happy and successful lives. And our aim would be nothing less than, in due course, turning all the public schools into Killara High or the equivalent of Killara High. Now, you know, that's what they do in places like Finland, and we can do it too. And as I say, we don't need to rob Peter to pay Paul. I think one of the great divisive debates in this country for a long, long time is how do we get good public education? You know, oh, it's always going to be at the cost of private schools, and it's not. So, I mean, one of the things we like to try and do in this party is not look for an us and them solution, not look for a winners and losers solution, but look to a winners and winners situation. And I believe that is what we're going to achieve with our education policy. If I may say so, I mean, it's exactly what Steve Keen is doing with this affordable housing policy. We're not saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to drop house prices so that young people can afford it and the rest of you can go to hell. No, he's taking into account the people that have been, if you like, the victims of the neoclassical force over the last 40 years, and he's protecting them. And you know, we're very, very proud of that. This is a world first. This is a really, really creative piece of economics, and we're just thrilled to be able to hopefully bring that to the Australian scene. And I think it will work, and I think it will work after us. I think it will work around the world. And how nice to be a world first for once, instead of being, you know, under our recent governments, the last in the world to do anything.
Yeah, innovation and forward thinking for a change. That's
just for once, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great, yeah. Isn't it? And what about the university sector, right? Because there's been recent changes to university funding. There's more focus on specific skills rather than, if you like, building the brain, if I can put it bluntly. What's that? What about the role of universities and, you know, just going after more international students? Is that an okay strategy, or is there an alternative strategy that we need?
I think we've been taught in no uncertain terms with COVID that it's a terrible strategy. I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't have foreign students. Of course we should. I mean, that enriches our universities. But to depend on foreign students to fund our universities is insane. And you get the situation that you get now where universities are on the brink of bankruptcy and government says, well, that's too bad for you. There's nothing we can do about that. But, of course, there is something that government can do about that. It can say that if education is the bedrock of society, then the pinnacle of that education, the place from which all your future entrepreneurs and creative capitalists and professionals and business people come, is the tertiary, is the education they get at a tertiary level. And again, you know, one doesn't need to be constrained by this false scarcity. If we, as we will, invest in the university sector and in particular that aspect of the university sector that goes to research, then not only are we spending a very productive dollar, and not only do we have the resources to back that, particularly if we bring home all the brain drain that we've lost, but we're creating the future on entrepreneurs. It's a multiplier effect of the highest order. Now, if I may say so, it's only the Philistines that run the two major parties that can't see this. I think any decent thinking person understands that. So our plan is to have free university education at the undergraduate level, or in some cases at the postgraduate level if it's creating a professional qualification like the postgraduate medical and law degrees and things like that. So that's our plan, and we think it will create a smarter country, and it will create a secure tertiary education country that's not on its knees begging government for a crumb. You know, they should be lauded and praised and you know, given the reins of the future, not crushed and demoralised. Similarly, it's part of our policy that primary and tertiary teachers are well paid, you know, and we can afford to do that. We can afford to do that in this country, and we should do that in this country. They are too often taken for granted and too often oppressed. We'll bring that to an end as well.
Visionary stuff, Victor, which is good to hear. And Steve, I want to throw this at you. To what extent do you think neoliberalism has actually infected our universities and our university systems such that they basically only teach the neoliberal view of the future?
Oh, very much so. And I mean, I've been an academic for 30 years now, and I've been involved in universities for 50 years. And I've seen the degradation that's happened to the quality of university education over that period of time. And universities now seeing their main job as raising money. You get some truly embarrassing situations where you're dropping your standards to try to get the cash in that you need to operate at whatever level you regard as necessary. And often that money goes to the upper bureaucrats, to the managers. In Australian university being paid well over $1 million a year, while the top academics are lucky they make 200,000, and the student academics doing all the work are lucky they've got a full-time job. They're working in the gig economy. So it's devalued everything, and the students end up suffering as well because it's becomes what I call credentialism. This is all driven by the idea that you should, you know, bring the profit motive to education. That's the wrong place for it. The motive for education should be the education motive. And on that basis, it should be free to get into the university monetarily and difficult intellectually. And that's what we need. We need to bring back the standards that used to exist in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Somewhat wider access, not a lot wider. I think the 70s got it about right. But definitely hard to get in, hard to pass, and not just qualifications, but knowledge and wisdom. being taught at universities and innovation being done by those universities with proper funding for research. So all that is vitally necessary. And the whole competitive market-driven thing has been a complete travesty. And what it meant is ultimately people like myself who happily went into the university sector 30-something years ago are now desperate to leave because it's such a miserable place to be. And the whole creativity has been stifled by a managerial class who wouldn't know educational research if they fell over it. But they're the ones who run the universities. What I'd be doing, I'd be pushing for universities to be run by elected staff representatives, where the staff didn't get paid any more money to be a vice chancellor, but got 5 years research time after with research staff after they did their term. And you get people who are actually caliber intellectuals running the universities rather than the second and third rate people that get there. And I'm not speaking from third, this is a second-hand opinion. I know some of these people firsthand. They're second and third rate, and yet they end up running universities and they're running them into the ground. And it's all been a result of neoliberalism. In many ways, it began with the Labor Party bringing in the HEC scheme as well. That was the beginning of the end, where now enormous student debt is attached to education across the world. That's another problem. We've ended up turning yet another avenue, part of society, into a reform for rentier capitalism. And it's been destructive of what education should really be about.
Well, one of the things I say is that over the last 30 years, people have become cash flows, right? So basically, you know, whether it's streaming services on Netflix or whether it's some HEX or whether it's a mortgage or whatever it is, right? The whole of society is built around you will go on paying and you will go on paying those cash flows. And people, of course, you know, economically speaking, they talk about a household's, you know, life value. In other words, how many cash flows are they going to have over their life? How much of it can I harvest, right?
Have mosquitoes talking about human bodies.
I mean, it is remarkable when you stop and think about it, just how deeply ingrained this whole philosophical mode is, right? You see it in politics, you see it in education, you see it in business, you see, you know, wherever you look. We've definitely lost something really, really important in this because it's a value set that is ultimately, I think, a bit bankrupt.
Totally. It's a one-dimensional view of society, one-dimensional man, as Marcuse once said, and that is reduced the richness of human society, and it's time we got rid of it. It doesn't even work on its own terms. That's why I wrote Debunking Economics. It's a dysfunctional vision of how a market economy itself functions. When you apply it to a intellectually and socially rich society, it debilitates that society. And, of course, it means we're also, in terms of things like climate change, far less prepared for the future we face than we would have been without this neoliberal period. So it's an enormous scourge that has to go. And, unfortunately, neither Liberal nor Labor in this country are fully aware of that. Liberal Party still trumpets it. I think the Labor Party is slowly starting to disown it, but they really started it in many ways under Hawke and Keating. And we want to reverse that mistake and go back to having a richer vision, a cultural vision of society, not just a dollar vision of society.
And so the key question then to me is the question of the Reserve Bank, the Treasury, our regulators, right? They all carry the same view of the world, the neoliberal view of the world, and basically it drives everything they do and everything they think about. So to what extent are we going to have to think about some of those issues if we're really going to start sort of turning the boat around and point it in somewhere different?
That's a big problem. And I've had plenty of personal experience with the Reserve Bank, and let's say I'm not particularly impressed with their level of thinking. I've had far better more time with what I've found inside the Bank of England and the Bundesbank and a few other of the central banks that are aware of the society being far more complex than the textbook business that still dominates how the Reserve Bank tends to think, and the Treasury. Now, what's happening in some of those organisations, and I know this firsthand again, they're starting to hire heterodox economists. They see a need for a change in orientation, and they're trying to find a way of bringing it about. So I know that I'm going to go talk to the Treasury. I might as well be talking to a brick wall in some cases. In fact, a brick wall might have a sharper wit to it. And ditto with the Reserve Bank. I'm not exactly expecting to be welcome friendly, and I can cope with an unfriendly welcome. But we really have to say, listen, what you've learnt as a way of talking about the way the economy functions is incorrect. You know that from the Bank of England itself. I think it was Clark inside the central bank came out, Reserve Bank recently came out and said, yes, the Bank of England is right, but that hasn't permeated through the research departments. So we need to be thinking in terms of complex systems, not dynamic, stochastic, general equilibrium models. We need them to be aware that the world is not as simple as the textbooks or their equilibrium models that they've spent the last 30 or 40 years building. So I'd be trying to bring some new blood into the Reserve Bank and the Treasury. I wouldn't be trying to spill blood there, but bring new blood in.
And just pursuing that slightly further, at the moment we have APRA, we have ASIC, we have the Reserve Bank, all of whom can say, not my problem, it's somebody else's problem, right?
Yeah.
Is there a structural issue here as well that you'd want to point to?
There is. Yeah, the whole idea of handing out responsibility to different groups to specialise meant you basically got the hot potato problem. They passed it amongst themselves, not my... I don't hold a hose, mate. I don't hold a hose, mate. You could have learnt that in APRA. So the extent to which there's been derogation of responsibility rather than assuming it as a one-stop shop. And in fact, the Bank of England is going more towards that sort of approach now, saying we can't farm out responsibility for securities to one group, regulation to another, monetary policy to a third. They have to be integrated. And again, that same thing would be, we're not going to be in power, obviously, but we are going to be arguing for a more integrated view of economic policy and the role of the government in society, which has been denigrated by neoliberal thinking, where the only role of government should be to not exist. And I've had plenty of conversation with mainstream economists where they pretty much argue that if we could abolish trade unions and government, everything could be hunky-dory. I'm sorry, guys, you've almost achieved it, and it's a mess.
Well, the point is that basically you leave everything to the market, right? Let the market decide. The market magically always does right? Now, just go back to the global financial crisis, and I remember the Fed chair afterwards saying, I made some assumptions about the way that the market would work, which proved to be completely wrong.
And he was right that he was wrong. But as time goes on, they try to forget what they learnt through a crisis. So later on, Greenspan came out and tried to correct himself and saying he was wrong. So he was right, wrong, right, all the way through. The mental gymnastics they go through is just ridiculous. And that's one reason why, I was delighted when Victor invited me to become an advisor at the party, because you need a deep understanding of just how wrong all this theory is. And that is not something I've seen in the career politicians, either the Liberal Party or the Labor Party. We need the community politicians, which is what we are, to say we want to get a government that functions properly for the society in which it's in, rather than being based on a theory that says government shouldn't exist, which is the foundations of neoliberalism.
Absolutely. But that does have a significant consequence in terms of corporates and the role of corporates and the role of corporations, many of whom, of course, are bigger than countries now.
Yeah. And for example, we haven't talked about this. I don't think people are going to contradict me here, but we want to get rid of political lobbying. We think at the moment we have the best government money can buy, and the richest people in the country are fossil fuel interests. And that's why we've got fossil fuel interests certainly dominating the Liberal Party and making a fairly embarrassing grab for the Labor Party as well. So we want to reform funding of political parties so that you don't get lobby groups buying the politicians they want. And that extends through to how the relationship between government and business as well. There's a good argument for interrelations between government and business and trade unions, which I was part of under the Accord back in the Labor Party days. Under Hawke and Keating, and Button in particular. Let's forget about Hawke and Keating. It was Button who did the good work back then. So we want to bring back that idea of a consortium or an interrelation between the three, but we don't want one buying the other. And if you leave it at the stage where the corporate sector can buy the politicians through lobbying and through offering nice positions to politicians after they retire, if they do good things when they're in power, then you get a very corrupt political system. And the founding basis of the New Liberals is to eliminate the corruption in Australian society.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a couple of interesting comments here. One that came up just now saying we need a government that will fight for working families, which is an interesting observation. And also this question here from Electro Fried: what are your guest thoughts on election reform, specifically the need to move away from our current system towards something like proportional representation of electoral systems in both houses? Victor, electoral reform, do we need it, or is what we've got working?
I personally think that what we've got would work if we didn't have a situation where you got the government, the government that money could buy, the best government that money could buy. So, in other words, I don't see the problem as the voting system that we have, because whatever voting system we have, if you get people buying governments through their donations and influencing government through their lobbyists, and lunatics like Palmer splashing $80 million across every possible advertising channel in the world saying nothing, you're going to have problems that no electoral system will overcome. I mean, I have great admiration for the proportional representation of the European system, and of course we have that in our own Senate. But many sophologists and experts have said that the system of elections that we have in the federal lower house is the best and fairest in the world. Now, obviously, opinions are going to differ on that, but I personally tend to agree, if it weren't tainted and corrupted. Anything that's tainted and corrupted isn't going to work, no matter how good it is as a practical tool.
Right, but the point you're making, I think, is that it's not the system itself, it's the way that it's been influenced and morphed, and it's
yes.
all of those externalities. So if you actually tackle some of those, the mechanisms yes. that are actually in place are potentially fit for purpose.
Absolutely, and yeah. you said it much better and more concisely than I did. Yes, I agree, exactly.
Well, you haven't done anything as bad as the American or British situation. I mean, the British is a joke. I used to think Monty Python was a comedy. After living there for a while, I realized actually it's a documentary series. And the, America,
the Beck,
even worth...
The best one, the Beck documentary, is Yes, Minister.
Absolutely. I just watched the one about, the Daily Mirror doesn't, about the, what the, how are you, the Guardian has people who think they should run the country. The Times are read by people who think they do run the country. The Financial Times read by those who do own the country. And then finally, so what about the Daily Mirror? And Bernard says, oh, they don't care who runs the country as long as she's got big tits. Yes, Minister's magnificent. But the thing is, in that overall spectrum, we do pretty well. I think if you wanted to find a better political system, you'd be talking New Zealand and Tasmania, both of which have some form of proportional representation at the representative level. But we've got a pretty good system. The compulsory voting means politicians can't ignore parts of the population, which, of course, is what they do in America. They try not to get you to vote. And the fact that it's preferential means minority parties can get a voice. And that is something which, again, we have as a great advantage over the UK and America. So we don't need reform at that level anywhere near as much as we need reform to stop money buying politicians.
Absolutely. Yeah. Put it like that. It's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Mm.
Okay. I think, Victor, this is probably one for you. Let me just put the chat up. There you go. What is the New Liberals' view with regard to their preferences? Where are you sending them? How are you using preferences? Now, if you say the system's fine, the preferences and how you use them becomes pretty important, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's first important to make perhaps the obvious point that when one talks about a political party's preferences, a person that wants to vote for that political party is not obliged to follow the recommended preferences on the How to Vote card. A lot of people don't know that, actually, and I think it may stem back to the misuse of those words, how to vote. It implies that you have no choice, but, of course, people can preference in whatever way they want. The other important thing to mention is that 50% of people now don't follow a how to vote card. So people are starting to wake up to the fact that it's a matter entirely for them. And I think even in the 50% that do follow a how to vote card, there's a lot that understand they don't have to follow that, but they're choosing to do it because they want to support the party and this is what the party's asking for. So it's important to make that point. But having said that, yes, the way that a party puts its recommended preferences, if you like, on its how to vote card has two really important factors attached to it. The first is that, you know, people will follow that. And the other is that you are signalling your intent. You're signalling what you consider matters. So we have a very firm, our policy is that we will always preference the LNP last. Now, that tells you something about us and where we think the major problem in this society lies. Beyond that, all we say is that we will, that our preferences will vary from seat to seat, depending on whom we think is the closest to our philosophy and the party or independent that would best, next best serve the community, I suppose, if we were not elected.
The Senate adds an extra level of complexity now because there actually has been a reform that I'm willing to call a reform with the Senate. You remember the crazy ballot the last time around when you put one vote above the line and then that all you could do was vote for one party and then the preferences were distributed by the party, which is where we got the, you know, preference whispering thing and people with trivial preference votes getting into the Senate. That's gone. So now you have to give one to six. At least six parties you must nominate. You can nominate more if you like. Now, what that means is you can put us first, Labor second, if you feel like it, Greens, third, fourth, fifth. We'd say, don't even put the Liberal Party up there. And in that case, your vote will not go to the Liberal Party at all. So there's control in that sense. Also, you can vote below the line. And if you now vote for 12 candidates, you might, I'd like to get some first votes that way, I must say. But it means rather than having to vote for 150 or 200 people down below the line, which was the old situation, you only have to vote for 12. So either six above the line or 12 below the line. And then the way the preferences work in the voting system is quite complex in the Senate. So we know the Liberal Party and Labor Party will get more than two quotas, more than enough votes for two senators, but not enough for three. So it's actually quite feasible that people could vote, for example, they could give their first preference to Labor, and their second preference to the New Liberals. And then if Labor got 2.5 preferences, and it's only going to be ridiculous to say we get the 100%, we could get half a Senate seat out of the excess votes from the Labor Party. So people can use their preferences very intelligently in the Senate, and basically we'd encourage them to do that. Okay, the sort of society you wish to see, you can actually vote for very deliberately in the Senate. Go ahead and do it. We think we're the best society for you to vote for. We'd like you to vote the New Liberals first. But if you can't bring yourself to do that, there's other ways you can still end up giving your preferences to us as an independent party to bring an honest voice into Parliament focused upon intelligence and integrity, and where we will stand for principle. We're not going to be bought out by anybody. We're not going to kowtow to anybody. So, you know, vote for us. But if you can't bring yourself to vote for us, give a second preference. It'll still work.
Yeah, work with the system, right? That's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. When I look at most things they're called reforms, I call them deforms. Okay? They make the system worse. That particular reform is a genuine reform. I think Australians should embrace it and use it intelligently in the Senate election.
But I'd make the point, Steve, very few people know that that's how it works.
So yeah, yeah.
There's an education problem, right?
I've got to cover that in my end. I'm going to put a website together, which I haven't had. I mean, my computer broke down, as you might know, over the weekend, so that job didn't get done. Mm. But yeah, so this is how you can use the preferences in an intelligent fashion. Mm. So six or more parties above the line, 12 or more individuals below, and you don't have to pass that point. So if you want to have the great pleasure of being somebody who's sick of the Morrison government and doesn't want to even put a number next to their name, you don't have to. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, forget the Liberal Party. Your vote, if your vote doesn't go to any of the first six you give, it's just exhausted. it doesn't pass on. So there's real intelligence. I must compliment whoever drafted that Senate reform. It's a genuine reform, and it's made the Australian political system better than it was beforehand.
Okay, good. Now let's move on to another policy area, and that's to do with superannuation, right? Because we were talking about debt and the size of the debt, but we've also got this other huge engine, you know, $3 trillion plus of superannuation. There was a comment earlier about Paul Keating's superannuation shrunk wages since 1991. I don't know whether that's true or not. But, you know, what's your perspective, Steve, or indeed Victor? I'm not sure who's, you know, going to take this. But
I'm going to hand over to Victor on this one. I might come in with other comments because I may step outside the boundaries of what the party's
actually. No, Steve, you're the next treasurer. This is for you, definitely.
I agree with that comment about Paul Keating. I was part of drafting. I didn't have a large role, but I played a minor role in drafting the Accord documents before Labor got into power. When you had the Hawke and Keating government, but it was done largely under Senator Button, who was one of the great visionaries of Australian politics. And the idea was to build a Swedish-style industrial system in Australia. And when it got into power, the economists inside the public servants of the public service, who were all neoclassical, pushed it towards wage restraint and reducing the rate of inflation by wage rises less than the rate of inflation were traded off against superannuation. So it became an anti-inflationary tool, which is not at all what it was supposed to be in the first place. And then, of course, superannuation became based upon your income. So the more income you earn, the more superannuation you had. Now, that replaces a system of pensions, where the pension was a decent standard of living for everybody who's past the working age. And that, again, was driven by the whole neoliberal vision that how's the government going to pay for it? And pay for all of it. You create the money, okay? The important thing is having the goods available at the time, being able to produce the goods and services that the pensioners can buy with their pension. So I am in favour of going back more in the direction of a pension system. I'm not going to abolishing superannuation. I think we're stuck with that as it exists, but it's been part of the corruption of the financial system as well. Just to go back to the 1870s, no, sorry, 1970s, in 1980s, pardon me, I'm getting my digits mixed up. In 1983, the amount of superannuation money that went into the stock market was 30% of the stock market funding. By 1987, it was 70%. And what happened on the 23rd or so of October, it fell 25% in one day because the superannuation money had pushed up the stock market. And then you got this whole feedback system between superannuation firms and stock market prices and so on. Again, it's part of the Ponzi scheme. So I want to get to the stage where superannuation does what it was supposed to do in the original Hawke and Keating ideas, which was to provide the funds to industrialise the country. Now, of course, it hasn't done that. So I think there's an enormous need to reform the superannuation industry as well and to bring back a living pension rather than, as you heard bloody Morrison saying, a pension is going to be a privilege, not a right. Well, screw that. We're going to get the back to the stage where it's a right of an Australian who's reached retirement age to get an income that lets them have a decent standard of living after they're no longer able to work.
I guess the question to my mind is what's happened with the superannuation system is that all of the market risks are now pushed back onto those who are saving.
Right? Yeah.
And as you say, if the markets drop, you know, people are talking about a 56% drop in the markets, that would mean that people's superannuation got crushed. If you go back 20, 30, 40 years, the idea was that there would be a minimum level of support that was universally accessible, right? Mm. And effectively, it was actually underwritten directly or indirectly by the government and by companies. So again, it's the neoliberal sort of spin, isn't it, that shoved everything back. The market risks are now being taken by those individuals. And by the way, there are lots of people clipping the ticket on the way through, you know, all the hangers-on.
Absolutely.
You think about all the fees that are taken out of the superannuation system and all of those people who've got rich off the back of that.
It's a travesty.
Yeah.
It's a travesty. Again, I'd rather have engineers than financial engineers. And what we've done by expanding superannuation, we've got far too many financial, and there's not enough people who understand differential equations can actually do engineering. So, yeah, we have corrupted the system by this focus upon finance. And again, in that sense, superannuation, as it's been practiced in Australia, is still part of the whole neoliberal agenda. we can't abolish it, but we want to tame it, and we want to get back to the stage where the primary principle is that a person, Australian, who's past working age will receive an income that enables them to have a reasonable lifestyle after they can no longer work.
Yep, absolutely. And philosophically, again, it's another echo of neoliberalism, right?
Yep.
And this is what I keep wanting people to understand, right? These same fundamental philosophical drivers are actually in pretty much every domain that you touch, whether it's education, whether it's the mortgage sector, or whether it's the superannuation sector. It is absolutely seeded through society.
It is, and it's reduced the caliber of society, the quality of society. It's made it much more fragile, and that's what we saw during COVID as well. I'm really pleased that we had a government-owned institution called the Australian Serum Laboratory that could instantly produce vaccines when the virus hit. Of course, that is actually a line from Yes Minister, because we sold the damn thing and privatised it, and we can't make vaccines. Again, the extent to which we've undermined our own capacity to be resilient really came home during COVID, as Victor said earlier, and it's going to come home even more so when climate change starts to hit. So we have to simply reverse direction in favour of resilience and local capability rather than the efficiency, which is actually fragility.
Now, earlier on, Cookie Boy asked a question, which I didn't want to bring in at the time, but what about the National Bank? Do we need effectively a national institution, an investment bank, to be able to make those infrastructure investments that are required for the future, or can we rely on the existing systems and processes that exist today?
I think that's an open question. I mean, an infrastructure bank implies that bank will then be trying to raise funds when the government can create the money in the first place, and maybe also making decisions about what those infrastructure investment should be, when perhaps that's what a sensible government should do. We've undermined the capacity of the government to do that over the last 40 years. You've seen the mess that's been made of COVID because the bureaucracy now sees itself as serving a political party rather than running the country. So all sorts of things need to be fixed on that front. I don't think you necessarily need an infrastructure bank, but I think we probably do need a public bank, which used to be called the Commonwealth Bank. And one of my favourite statements was by Hugh Stretton, the brilliant both economist and urban planner out of South Australia, died some years back. And he had a bolshy bunch of staff, left-wing staff, at one of their parties at one stage. One of them said, all housing should be public. And Hugh replied, no, they need us to keep them honest, and we need them to keep us efficient. So a mixed system where you have both public and private banks, I think, makes more sense than the totally private system we have right now. So that, the young ones, yes, great for the young ones. that is the sort of world we need to consider. And all this denigration of that old world, that's why we talk about going back in some sense to the time of Menzies. We certainly don't believe in everything Menzies stood for. But you find back at that time an accepted set of principles about the need for a rich and diverse society and having more than just the dollar measuring the worth of people and the role of government. So, and so much of that has been denigrated by neoliberalism. And so Malcolm Fraser at one stage was asked, why did he leave the Liberal Party? And he answered, I didn't leave the Liberal Party, the Liberal Party left me. Well, even more so to Menzies back in those days.
Great quote. Victor, I want to come to you now and talk about international policy, right? You know, the Russian situation. We've got China, we've got the US, we've got the very strong alignment between Australia and the US. What's your perspective in terms of the way that international policy should be run, and how well are we doing at the moment?
Well, the same answer to most questions that pertain to this government. We're doing very badly. I don't think they could do it any worse. You know, people say that about how they've handle COVID. They couldn't do it any worse. I don't think they could handle foreign affairs any worse. Saber rattling at the Chinese, getting to a situation where the French president calls you a liar on the international stage, and rightly so, where you rush so headlong to service what you think America needs, that the American president has to turn around and say, I'm not sure we actually needed that. You know, I'm a bit upset that you upset the French president, you know. I mean, and diplomacy has disappeared. You know, I think, you know, these things are incredibly complex, but there are certain fundamentals that need to be observed. One is you defend yourself and you prepare your defense quietly, and you use professional diplomats to negotiate with the countries that you have concerns about. You don't rattle your sabers loudly. Well, that might be all right if you were the British Empire in the 19th century. You had a lot of sabers to rattle. You know, we don't have any sabers to rattle. So to rattle our 2.5 sabers at the Chinese is just madness. And to treat them as these politicians do. Anyone who isn't Anglo-Saxon gets treated as a lesser being, and they know that and they feel that. And they're not, are they? And so you are making lifetime enemies of powerful nations when you should be doing everything you can, particularly a country like China that we trade with, you know. So you institute quiet defense, powerful diplomacy, and bring a bit of basic intelligence to the human interrelationships that are really at base no different between the presidents and prime ministers of countries and two human beings having a coffee. You know, how they don't see this, I mean, the debate is always, are they totally stupid or is there some sort of sinister intent behind this? And I never know the answer to that, but it's kind of an irrelevant question because it's a cock-up, isn't it? You know, the whole thing. So we would want to, sorry, but we would want to get back to some sort of basic international diplomacy. And as you and I were talking about, Martin, off air, you've got to get away from this black and white. Who's the baddie? Is it China? Is it America? You know, of course, you know, things are complex. People are complex, and nations of 1.2 billion people and 360 million people respectively are profoundly complex. And to try and treat them as some sort of, you know, chips to move around a casino table, really, really not very good.
And it seems to me that we perhaps are doing diplomacy through social media and, you know, those quick headlines and those sort of positions. And also, of course, assuming that if the US says jump, we have to jump almost regardless, seems to be the two tenets of how we make foreign policy at the moment.
Well, this idea that if the US says jump, we say how high, that's been around for a long time. And I'm not quite sure why it has to be so. You know, again, a little bit of behind-the-scenes discussion with the US before you tell them that you've just sucked the French submarines to the bottom of the ocean and you're going to buy theirs before they even know it, you know. Not great policy.
And what about Russia? What's the perspective there? You know, is the story of Russia being told adequately and appropriately, or are we actually fanning the flames for a particular ends? Or, you know, what's going on? What's your perspective, Victor?
We don't. We have a China policy. We don't as yet have a Russia policy. My own personal view is that the China situation is not told properly. The cultural differences that we have with China are not taken into account. The way in which China likes to exercise its influence is not properly considered. But I think, and this is just me personally, but I think that Putin is a pretty powerful and unassailable character. And someone who, you know, has no love of Western Europe or the United States or us, and I think he's a dangerous man. What we do about that, I'm not sure, but I think we'd be, you know, there's strong arguments that say, for example, that China will not engage in military conquest because it's not how they do things and it's not how they need to do things because they're very successful in conquering the world with aid and Belt and Road social media and you know, all sorts of acts on the internet and so on. To me personally, Russia seems a much more blunt tool. It does seem to be a lot easier for us to understand, and suggestions that they are warlike are being proven all the time. So a very different situation, I think.
But it sounds to me as though we need to grow up in terms of the way that we think about our international relations, right?
Oh, yes. And sorry, I don't mean to suggest that we do a black and white on Russia either. Mm. Again, we want strong diplomatic ties, trade ties if we possibly can. If you have strong diplomatic and trade ties, it's very hard for someone to go to war against you. We also need to recognize that we are a long way from Russia, and that's great, you know, and that's something that should be taken into account.
Okay. Well, we're coming into the last 10 minutes of the show, can you believe? I don't know where the time's gone. But what I wanted to try and do was to shift the thing a little bit forward, right? So from a vision perspective, right, and Victor, I'm going to ask you first, and then I'll perhaps get Steve to come in. What sort of society would actually be the end outcome of your policies if you were successful in getting elected and, you know, doing all the things you wanted? How would we notice the difference? What are the main things that would change, and how would society be different, and, you know, what would be those critical outcomes?
Well, rather than talk about all the detail and the indicia, I think I can simply say that you would observe a society that once again values compassion, justice, integrity, and equality of opportunity. And it's really interesting. I mean, we have, I hope, in all due humility, a range of amazing and creative policies, many of which have come from the pen of Professor Stephen Keen. But out on the hustings at the moment, I find myself answering just as I answered you. People say to me, well, how are you different from other parties? And I say, well, we believe in compassion, justice, integrity, and equality of opportunity. You know, all those things that have become unfashionable with the Liberal Party of Australia and the Labor Party, the Australian Labor Party, and are totally ignored in the discourse, in the political discourse. And, you know, I must have said that now to 1,000 people. And nobody disagrees with me. What I see when I say that is a twinkle in their eye, a light in their eye, and a smile and a nod, because that's what we've forgotten. I mean, Steve was talking about it. We need to stress, or maybe you were talking about it, Martin. I can't remember the cultural aspects of our society. But those cultural aspects and those educational aspects and key aspects that drive a society, they arise out of the fact that a society has been established which is compassionate and just and gives equality of opportunity. And people forget that those things don't come out of legislation, they come out of leadership. If you have a leadership that says, these are the things we want, these are the things we value, people get it, you know, and they say, well, if I pursue a just and compassionate end, I won't be punished for that. I won't be taken advantage of. I won't be laughed at like Freudenberg does whenever, you know, you mention anything to do with any sort of decent human emotion. I will be rewarded for that because my government is telling me that is the way in which they want this country to move. So I don't know if that really answers your question properly, but that's the sort of end product that we want to achieve. And I think it can be done quite quickly. it's quite amazing when a different sort of leadership comes in that says we want these things. It can be very quick that people turn around, because I still believe, despite everything I've seen in my long life, I still believe that the vast majority of people are good people and want to do good things and want to have that sort of compassionate, just society. And if they don't practice it, it's because they've been taught to fear. And if you take that fear away, you know, some people say there's only two emotions, fear and love. Okay, you take away the fear, give them some love and say, you know, I know I'm sounding very hippie here, but you know, some of those hippie ideas aren't too bad at the end of the day.
And look, it seems to me, you know, slightly standing back as a philosopher, the key point that people need to grasp is there are decisions that can be taken that can make things different, right? We're yes. not locked in no. necessarily to just repeating the same old, same old, same old and getting the same outcome, right? But
yeah, that's right.
That means recognizing, one, that there is an opportunity to change things, and two, there are yeah. levers that can be pulled to change things, and three, if you pull those levers in the right way, you can actually wrought a different type of society, as you say, that's more embracing and perhaps a little more yep. confident in its own outcomes, but also not driven just by the dollar, but yep. driven by other values, and it's about what value set. So it's a genuinely open opportunity to make a difference and to go somewhere different, right?
Well, go on. Yes.
I was going to say, I think that when I talk to people, a lot of people have almost given up.
Hmm. Yep. And that is our challenge. It's one thing to say what we will do if and when we're fortunate enough to get into government and change things. There, as I say, when people can see it happening in front of their eyes, they can turn around very quickly. But our great challenge is to convince people of just what you've said, Mark, that everything that happens in our society is the direct result of a political decision somewhere along the line. And it's in the interests of those neoliberal politicians to let you believe that there are certain, you know, immutable laws. There's always got to be so much unemployment. There's always got to be the gig economy. There's always got to be, you know, whatever. And I have to say it is the hardest thing for us to get across. So, again, out on the streets and the supermarkets and so on, I'm talking to young people, and I talk to them I attack them with Steve Keen's affordable housing policy, because, you know, I'm so excited by that and so proud that that's part of our policy. But I watch them looking at me like, as if to say, but that's not how the world works, is it? You know, now, will they at the end of the day give us a chance to prove that that is how the world could work, or won't they? That's the big question. And we've got to be very, it's ironic and a touch melancholic even, that we have to fight with every oratorical skill we have to convince people that you can bring back justice, compassion and a decent life. Because they have been terribly, terribly conditioned in the last 40 years to believe that everything that happens to them is a given, unfortunately.
And the reason I brought this up was because the leader of the opposition today, in his press address, talked about the need to try and actually reconnect all the bits of Australia, you know, and the states are sort of going different directions. But there was nothing there in terms of what levers he'd pull to make that happen other than just continuing to do what they've always done, right? And it seems to me that if you actually start talking about a different value set and a different set of outcomes, you do actually have to have some levers and policies and things to convince people that it is achievable, right? Because it being achievable is the other part of the problem.
Yeah. Well, he's got policies that are exactly the same as the government. They have policies that are exactly the same as the government. Every piece of shameful legislation that this government's passed in the last 12 months has been supported by the Labor Party. So how he thinks he's going to make a difference, I don't know. But on top of that, I don't know if you know, but up in Queensland, he was quoted as saying that the Labor Party is shifting position to become the party of the aspirational voter. Now, if there was a tiny crack left that differentiated the Labor Party from the Liberal Party, It was that they at least claimed to be a Labor Party, i.e. a party that is there to help labourers or the working person. Now, everybody knows what what, you know, the party of the aspirational voter means. I just, by the by, I found it really amusing. I tweeted only his words. I said, Anthony Albanese has just said, quote, the Labor Party has now become the party of the aspirational voter. That's all I did. I quoted him. And hundreds of Labor supporters jumped on Twitter and said, leave Labor alone. Stop criticizing him. And I said, how can a quote, a direct quote from your leader, without comment, constitute a criticism? Mm. But they all know that they are selling out. They have sold the farm piece by piece, and there's barely a chicken coop left, you know.
Well, they're following the Blair playbook, aren't they?
Oh, that's well, and more.
And more, yeah.
Yeah, it all began here.
And Steve, let me come to you. I want to come back to this sort of value set and how do you know that you've been successful by what you're doing, right? Your policies around housing, your policies around dealing with the debt, right, are some very tangible things. But above that, you know, what are those different behaviours you hope to see coming out of the back of it?
Well, fundamentally getting away from a world dominated by speculation and Ponzi schemes and getting a society that tries to be creative again. And we have all these wonderful cliches about how Australia invented the photocopier, invented GPS, all of which are true, of course, and we then outsource them to the rest of the world and don't do anything domestically, end up importing the damn thing, and we only make money out of, selling each other different schemes to buy access to the GPS system. So we've lost that creative side, but it's still there. So I want to regain the creative, innovative side of Australian society, and I want one which is focused upon fairness as well, as Victor has said. And one thing which makes it possible for you to actually take a risk and try to innovate is a guarantee that you're not going to starve if you fail. And so they're getting away from this neoliberal attitude that, you know, you should only your income should only be what you manage to earn from your labour. And if your idea doesn't work, then you fail. That actually prevents people being innovative. They take less risks if their own underlying security is undermined by, if you take a risk and you fail, you die. So to some extent, providing a society where everybody gets a reasonable income, including pensioners, is one thing I'm very focused upon now, the extent to which we've got pensioners living in poverty because we've let superannuation take over rather than basic provision by the government. You want a world where people feel secure, and when you're secure, you can take risks. If you don't feel secure, you're trapped on the current treadmill. And we've trapped people on a monetary treadmill and a speculative treadmill for the last 40 years. And I think it's led to a very fragile and very schizophrenic society. And I want to get to a stage where there's a richness to Australian culture again, which we've lost in the last 20 or 30 years on this neoliberal playbook.
Well, Steve and Victor, I want to say thanks to you both for spending this time with us tonight, and for being so open with regards to your thoughts and policies. I've only scratched the surface on the questions, but, you know, we'll have to come back and do some more because there's lots of other areas. But I think there's some really important messages coming through from the conversation, right, about understanding that there is stuff here about the future and about how the future can be malleable, right? And I guess my take out from that is that the policies that you guys are crafting are actually pointing in the different direction to where we've been the last 30 years, and that's goodness.
Thank you very much, Martin. I really appreciate the chance to be on here. It's always great fun. And I like that you let us talk so much.
Well, that's what this is all about. So no, thank you both very much. Really appreciate it. And we should do it again sometime, because I think there's a lot more we can discuss as your policies develop, as you know, the marketplace develops. But hopefully each time we build on the previous conversation and take the conversation a bit further. That's my intent. So thank you both very much. I'm going to take you offline now, and I'll close the show, and I look forward to catching up with you guys again soon. Thank you both.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, so there we are, folks. Just in terms of the next couple of days, there's a show coming up tomorrow. This is a one-off show. I've got Robbie Barwick coming on tomorrow talking about Russia and what the WTF, right? 26th, 8 p.m. Sydney. So mark your diaries for that. Special show tomorrow. And then my next show on the normal next Tuesday, 1st of February, is with Damien Klassen, and I'm going to be talking about the markets and what's going on there with him. A lot going on, of course, with markets falling out of bed and doing all sorts of weird things. So lots of interesting conversations there with Damien as well. So, as I say, tomorrow with Robbie, and then next Tuesday with Damien. Anyway, I want to say thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. I hope you found that useful. Send me more questions if you'd like to get more questions to Steve and to Victor. We'll probably run another show down the track. Otherwise, have a great evening. Have a good Australia Day if I don't see you tomorrow. And we'll see you next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.